Welcome to Power Talk, the interview portion. I'm very, very privileged today and very excited to be with Marianne Williamson.
Hi.
You're very familiar with her, I'm sure, from A Return to Love. It's the number one bestseller all across the country. What you may not know about her is the kind of philanthropist she is and what she does to make a difference in people's lives. She's the chairman and founder of both the Manhattan and Los Angeles Centers for Living, where she basically provides non-medical treatment, I guess is the best way to describe it, for people with life-threatening illnesses and people who are going through tremendous levels of grief. And Marianne, I've been very excited to meet you for some time. And
thank you so much, Tony.
So
I feel the same way about
you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having us in your home. I want to start out right away at the beauty. We talked before we got on tape here. I think the beauty of your message is that you've taken a work that is truly a miracle, and you've taken that work and brought it to life, and you've brought strength to it. And what I'd really love to have you share with people, those who maybe haven't read your book, what is your story? How did you come to this place? You start out kind of a rebel, it seems like. And
no more than anyone else I know. I don't think that...
Well, you know a lot of rebels.
I think that's the point, because we're a pretty rebellious generation. I don't think that there's anything unique about my story. I think if there's anything interesting about my story, it's that it's not unique. A lot of times people will say they have an extraordinary story to tell. Somebody lived an extraordinary life, and they're going to make a movie about this person's life, or they're going to write a book about this person's life and really analyze the extraordinary aspects of this person's experience. Now, I go to a movie like that, and I'm not educated as much as if someone could explain to me what's going on in what we call ordinary lives,
right?
Because that's my experience.
Right.
So sometimes, you know, the media will try to make much of, she did drugs. Well, who didn't do drugs,
right,
and
right,
sex and rock and roll? Who didn't? So
right,
that's really just more a pronouncement of my socioeconomic and age group,
sure,
than it is about anything particularly.
Sure. But you did things like at 15, your father took you to Vietnam.
That's true. That was somewhat different, absolutely.
Yeah,
my father is definitely a character, the likes of which they don't seem to make anymore, and he did take us all around the world when we were young, and that is different. And I did have the experience as a child, the experience of knowing that people were basically the same everywhere.
Tell me about, you got to a point, though, where I believe you describe it as just having so much pain that the Course in Miracles was your personal teacher and your path out of hell, in essence. What made you finally get to that point, you said, where you were like ready for a change?
There's a line in A Course in Miracles, a common line in Alcoholics Anonymous,
mm-hmm,
crowds, sick and tired of being sick and tired.
Right.
Whatever that bottoming out is. And you know, in your own work too, at what point is someone willing to listen?
Right.
And at some point, they're willing. I'm sure that there are many people said, you know, Tony Robbins, I wasn't interested. And then one day, somebody had a tape, I saw the book, I saw him on television. It was time.
Right.
I'm sure people said that to you. They've said it to me. 3 years ago, I walked into your lecture, Marianne, I thought you were a crazy woman. Then my boyfriend went into recovery and I was in Allenville 3 years later. It's like, you've changed. Well, I hadn't changed. Right?
It's like how bright your parents get.
Yes,
after you grow,
yes, right? Amazing. They've grown.
Yeah, that's right. Why do you think it takes pain for people to get to that point?
Interestingly enough,
I don't think it always does.
Oh, important point. Course in Miracles makes it very clear it does not take pain. You
right,
can come to the truth through pain. You can come to the truth through joy. It's
good.
Totally your choice.
I agree.
And I think that's very important.
Why
do
you think more
people
go for
well,
pain, though?
That's
first,
the point, that undeniably in a society like ours, most people do not come to people like you and me because everything's going so well.
Yeah, sometimes right, they do, but it's not always the first place.
There's a line in the Course in Miracles that says, it is not up to you what you learn, but merely whether you learn through joy or through pain.
Interesting.
So I believe when it's time for the soul to learn its next lesson, you will either embrace the lesson or you will continue to resist it and the pain will ultimately become so great that you die or you crack.
Tell me, what is the essence of the Course in Miracles? What was the message that grabbed you and made this your path?
That only the love in my life was real, that love was infinitely available to me, that I am loved in this universe, and that has nothing to do with whether or not I'm popular among
right,
certain people,
right,
that I have value to this universe, because everyone does, that I'm infinitely capable of contributing profoundly,
yeah,
that life has a meaning,
yeah,
and that everything else is nonsense.
Yeah. How do you stay focused on that?
To practice.
Yeah. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Huh? People want to hear a different message than that, but that's the reality.
No. And any given day, you listen to the kinds of tapes that say it, you read the kind of books that say it, you look at you do what it takes.
You feed your mind, you feed your soul.
It's no different and feeding your body. On the day you eat junk food, you won't feel so great.
Right.
On the day that you eat good food and you exercise, you will feel better. It's no different with the mind. And it's like physical exercise also, because you don't get to say, well, my body's in shape now, I can stop.
Right.
I always say the more you meditate, the more you need to meditate.
Some people say, well, your life all becomes purely about that and everything else loses value.
Oh, that's ridiculous. What's your response? Those are just, you know, if you have time to take a bath, you have a time to do this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's ridiculous. The point is, if you meditate for 20 minutes in the morning, you are so much more effective throughout your day. You save time.
Right. When you do your meditation, what do you pull from that experience? Or what do you reconnect with?
I always say that each of us has a direct radio line to God, but for most of us, they're static in the radio. And God is that, what is so oftentimes in spiritual literature called the small, still voice within. Mm-hmm. And you can know it's there, but not experience the peace of it.
Right.
And we live in a world that is so full of frantic stimulus. It's constant. In most places that we live, you know, I went to Telluride last week. You get to actually hear silence. In a city like this, you rarely hear silence, because just underneath the conscious level, you are telepathically picking up someone is screaming somewhere in this town. Someone in this town is probably in extreme physical pain caused by incredible violence at this moment. And on some level, we hear them.
I know you're good friends with Dr. Deepak Chopra, as am I, and he talks about pheromones, you know, being in a room, that when the emotional state is changed, that there's a physical reality to our picking up those senses.
That's why I'm always so touched by people doing this kind of work in New York City.
Yeah.
There's something poignant about it.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Let's talk about Course in Miracles from the standpoint of, you know, people say, okay, so I got to love. Love is the source. Love is God. I know I'm loved. What do you think keeps people from knowing that? You say that we're all start out programmed as children to focus on the things that make the difference, to know who we really are. What takes us out of that state, and
well,
what's the solution?
Well, of course, the message of the Course in Miracles is that the thought system of fear, which is the mind within us, I call it like a gravitational force field, which mitigates against our ability to love, the constricting mind as opposed to the expansive mind, the instinctive move for the jugular, whether it's my brother's jugular or mine. It is so built into our mental habit patterns that this world is dangerous and people are dangerous.
And to look for happiness outside yourself,
yes,
by controlling
all that stuff,
environment.
The whole thought system of fear rather than love, so that we get to the point where the Course in Miracles says we instinctively go for the fearful thought rather than the loving one. And unnatural thinking feels natural, and natural or loving thinking feels unnatural. There is a temptation within us at every moment to find the Son of God guilty instead of innocent. And from that one error comes every kind of peace-destroying thought of which we're capable. And that's hell.
Well, where does fear come from? Where does it emanate from? What creates it in the first place? Why would we have it in this world? And, you know,
well, we don't have it in heaven, of course, in miracles. Right. It's not real. Right. And that's why you can't rationally explain an irrational moment.
Yes.
It's a hallucination. It's an illusion. However, as the Course says, illusions are as powerful in their effects as is the truth. I might have an illusion that I'm no good. I'm just too short. I can't make it in this world. Well, it's a total illusion. It's ridiculous. There's a place in this world where my height would mean nothing to the people that matter.
Right.
But if I believe that my height will keep me from progressing, then that will be real in my experience.
Right.
The thought's just an illusion.
Right.
But that is the point of living on this earth. That's the classroom experience.
So tell me, what is the purpose on this earth? If love is the natural state, which I obviously believe it is, and the natural process is to allow and to share that experience with all those other human beings and souls you can touch, why do we have fear out there? Why are we here? Why do we have the illusion, at least?
It began millions and millions of years ago in time as we know it, according to the Course in Miracles. It's the story of the exile from the garden.
Right.
The moment the Course in Miracles says at which the Son of God forgot to laugh. The original detour into fear, the separation from God. The closest that we can get, the Course in Miracles says, to understanding why we ever split from God or love is to ask ourselves, why do I do it in this moment? Because all we're doing in every moment is reenacting the original separation. So if we can look at what's happened to you since you woke up this morning, and looked at every moment where you had a thought of constriction rather than expansion, a thought where your heart was closed instead of open, a thought where you thought of limited possibilities rather than infinite possibilities. If you can ask yourself why you do that, that's the same question as asking why we did it millions and millions of years ago. Because time doesn't exist anyway. We're just replaying the scene.
So what's the purpose of life?
To transcend that.
Interesting.
To go the other way.
And that's
and to experience the joy that we're capable of because of it, which is exactly what you teach.
And that's how spiritual muscles are developed.
Absolutely.
By pushing against that, the gravitational
force. Choose again, as A Course in Miracles says, choose once again. And that's...
And you do that every day.
You know, I suppose, Tony, I don't know, and I don't know what your experience is, I suppose that there's such a thing as... In fact, I know there's such a thing as the enlightened master whose instincts have so been transformed. There's a line in the Course where he says, I look forward to the day... The Holy Spirit says himself, he says, I look forward to the day when you're so at my level that you don't need my guidance. Until then. Until then, let me stand guard.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. So I'm not an enlightened master, so I can't speak about the point at which you don't even have to work at it anymore.
Well, that's good. That's called a good, clear, and honest response. So in life, though, fear really comes from, I think the way you describe it is it comes from separation. So how do we cause ourselves to feel reunified? I mean, we look out at the world right now and you see a tremendous cycle of fear. I mean, it's not hard to see, right? And people are running around with a fear about the future, the fear about their lives, fear about AIDS, fear about all these different things. And that fear is causing, I think, huge numbers of people just shut down. It's a very, you know, I wouldn't say scary time because I see everything as cyclical and I think it'll balance out again. But how do people get out of the fear? How do you get away from that and get back into a state where you have that sense of certainty and that sense of caring and that sense of connectedness with people?
In A Course in Miracles, it says that fear is to love as darkness is to light. Mm. Darkness is not an entity of its own. It's merely the absence of light. Mm. And that's what fear is. Fear is not an entity. It's merely the absence of love. Where love is present, fear cannot exist. The Western mind, particularly, we tend to analyze the problem rather than gearing ourselves towards an answer.
Right. And whatever you focus on, you get more of anyway.
Exactly. So whatever it is, you know, I think that there's an issue here, and this is where personal empowerment comes in, as you and I were discussing, of providing the solution.
Right.
When you become solution-oriented, I say in my book that when people come up to me and they say, Marianne, I'm devastated by world hunger. And I'll say, well, do you pay $5 a month to one of those organizations? Because if you do, if you are in any way providing a part of the answer in any of the world's problems, in that area you tend not to be as desperate as the people on the sidelines. I've been an AIDS activist for years, and I'm not as depressed about AIDS as many people I know because they're just going, tsk, 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 you know? It's so terrible.
Yes.
And that's why I feel that way. They're not part of the answer. Remember in the 60s when people said, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem?
Right. So the real solution to start with is to start with yourself and to start with cultivating the emotion of love continuously, especially when it's not easy, especially when you get hooked.
I think you start first with primary intention. You make a decision on this earth. What I'm going to be in one army. You know, there was a song by Bob Dylan several years ago, you're going to have to serve somebody. Remember that wonderful slow train coming? You're going to have to serve somebody. He said, it might be the devil and it might be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. And that
pick your side.
Exactly, because you are. It's like somebody says, I didn't vote for the presidential election. No, you voted. If you didn't vote, you voted.
Yeah.
So energy is such that you are in every moment with every thought and every aspect of your being contributing to the creation of a new world or to the status quo, which is steadily headed down.
And what keeps us in that place of contributing, I think what keeps most people in the place of not contributing, I should say, is their fear that they really, that they'll try to contribute and it won't make a difference. Most people have tried so many things, you know, that we've all been sold someday, someone, something, some amount of money, some amount of, you know, contribution, and then you'll be happy. And they go through all this stuff and they achieve these goals and then they say, is this all there is? What's the message that person needs to hear to let go of that false belief?
That you, first, one of the things you have to give up, though, is the belief that the prize is your personal happiness.
Mm.
A mature person thinks more than about their personal happiness. They think about whether or not their children and their children's children and their children's children's children will inherit a planet that's even inhabitable. So if you're thinking only in terms of what personal rewards will I get from contributing, you're not really in a contributive mode.
Right. That makes total sense. I remember reading you said that you know, excessive pride and ego and greed are, I think you said, the values of a dying culture. What are the values of a living culture?
Service. Joy, peace, harmony, compassion, nurturing, infinite possibility, faith, embrace of goodness, embrace of happiness, embrace of joy, approval, support, and belief in the innocence in ourselves and others.
And what keeps us from that is judgment. So how do you blow beyond the judgment? How do you stay at that level?
I think when you have experienced enough pain in that realm,
yes,
you get serious about going in another direction. That's why there's no point in trying to convince somebody else.
Yeah.
See, once you've really hurt, I think, once you really... See, I'm sure you would agree with this, Tony. You know, it's like the Abraham Lincoln of all people. The line most people, he said, I think, are about as happy as they make up their mind
right.
to be.
Right.
Usually, with working with as many people as I've worked with, and I'm sure you would agree, most people are in misery. I'm not talking about circumstantial misery.
Right.
I'm talking about the chronic misery,
right.
because there's still a payoff in it for them.
There's no question.
I mean, if they want to, that's fine. And I say to people all the time, I have no judgment of that mode that you're in. I just want you to know there's no mystery to it. And I will not join with you. There's no mystery there. And I will not join with you in thinking it's your only choice that you can make.
Yes.
Now, I'm not going to waste my time by trying to get you to make another choice. But if you're ever interested, I have some ideas if you are interested.
Another path.
Yeah.
But until people are so directed and guided by their programming of what ways they've learned to get out of pain and into pleasure. And as you say, some people by accident discovered that by having a problem or by being ill or being depressed, they get more attention than by being productive.
Absolutely. And I think that that's very true in the world today. There are so many people to support you in your misery. There's so many people to support you in your feeling of victimization. And sometimes it's harder to find someone to support you in your success
yeah.
and in your happiness
like
and in
easy
your
for
joy.
You. Yeah, you're
yeah.
easy for
right,
you.
Right, right, right. And you have to decide whose respect you want.
Right. Well, maybe you'll start with your own and with God.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I think that I would think that you could relate to this. Sometimes you go hear a musician, let's say, and everybody in the audience loves them, but you don't know why everybody's so impressed.
Right.
Another time you go hear a musician and you think that you have just heard the most profound performance you've ever heard in your life, and not many people in the audience seem to get how profound it is. And you begin to realize that if you're on stage talking, singing, whatever, you imagine yourself on the back row and you say to yourself, would I respect this performance?
Interesting.
And that's what I've always
the higher standard.
Gone by.
That's nice. And you and I are out there trying to support people and challenge ourselves to grow and expand. How do you deal with people who are just so close, they think that the only reason to really pursue knowledge or profound knowledge or skill or ability to change or improve their life is if they got a problem, they got to wait to that point, or that somebody who's doing that must be doing something wrong, or, you know, I've experienced criticism, you've experienced criticism. How do you deal with those things and stay balanced and continue to be loving and continue to give? Because you do that extremely well.
Well, I don't know if I do that extremely well in the privacy of my own home, but I think when it comes to anybody wanting to find truth however they want to find it, I don't have any belief that I know what's best for anyone. So their
but
choices
how do you feel
are their
when somebody
choices.
Like attacks
but when
your
someone
view.
Attacks mine, I not only hurt terribly just on a personal level because I don't think I deserve
right.
some of the things that have been said, it frightens me for this country.
Why?
Because the press has become such a vehicle for viciousness and judgment. Seeing themselves as a watchdog for everyone else, but there's no watchdog of them. They get to hide behind the First Amendment no matter what happens. And I've seen in my own life how tempting it is to just shut up and go home. And listen, in my life, some, you know, nasty articles, big deal. But when you think of what it's done to this country, think what it's done to our political field, how so many times
who wants to run?
The best and the brightest in America just wouldn't even. It's too painful for themselves and their family.
Yeah.
It's just too much to put a family through. It's like when on Primetime Live, when they asked John Kennedy Jr., what he felt about all the stories about his father's sexual prowess. And his response was, I think the real question is whether, if the climate had been the way it is today, my father would even have run.
Interesting question. What's your advice, though? I'm not saying so much just for you or for me, but anyone who's going to try to do something that's of value, anybody who's going to stick their head above the crowd is, you know, going to be attacked.
People
so what's
can
the message?
Smell. People can smell the truth. As the Course in Miracles says, nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists.
You,
20 million people might have read an article in something like a People magazine with all kinds of lies about you, but they can't make the lies true.
That's true.
And they can't make the truth about you a lie.
Right.
And you have to...
They can mess with your reputation, but not with your character.
Not with the truth about you. Yeah. They can't make a lie true. They can print a lie, but they can't make it true. So I think that, you know, if the course is accurate, which I believe it is, that only love is real and nothing else exists, truth comes around. You wait 3 days between the crucifixion and the resurrection. Hmm. But in today's society, I mean, look, in today's society, people just say outrageous things about people, and a few months later, it's just like one big dysfunctional relationship where people come home after dinner and they forgot they even said it.
Interesting. And then what's your belief about the future? Do you think that we'll get enough pain in this, we'll finally break the pattern?
Well, I believe that the darkness is intensifying and the light is intensifying. Mm-hmm. So I think for people like us, we get to the point, as I'm sure you feel also, where you almost take it for granted.
Right.
The forces that would snipe at you, and you realize, of course, they snipe at you. As I said to you before we even started the tape, in a way, what's being unconsciously played out here, it's almost a compliment, because the forces of entrenched power, which are forces of darkness, greed, and fear on this planet, do get, at least unconsciously, what a threat the message of empowerment and love is.
Right.
To the system that now dominates. So they're right. It's almost a compliment that they see us as such major threats. And of course, when a woman stands up there and has the audacity to speak her mind.
Yes.
You know.
With some passion and some intensity.
Right. And Mother Teresa, of course, they don't mind because she was no sexual threat at all.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I had the privilege of meeting her, and I asked her, I said, what gives you the most ecstasy in life? And after I said it, I thought ecstasy might not be the right word for none, but I said, she smiled and she knew what I meant. And she said, you know, what I love most, she said, is to see a person die with a smile on their face. I thought, wow.
I've seen people die with smiles on their faces, and I agree with her that it's a high moment. It's not my greatest
What gives you the greatest ecstasy? What gives you the greatest passion in life?
Love. And I agree with her that I have seen death scenes that were full of love.
Yeah.
But I think if I had my druthers on any particular day, I'd go for it in another realm. But
like,
she's right.
It's not happen. My number one up there, but I mean, that's what's driven her life. I'm curious, what has really driven you? What has brought you to want to share this message? Not only to experience the message, but want to share it on such a large scale.
I don't think that I want to share it on a large scale. I don't think that's my motivation, but that doesn't mean that that's what my intention or desire is. I want to shout it from the rooftops, but I think I'd want to shout it from the rooftops if no one was in town.
Oh, I see. So it's just it's just expressing what's
inside. I love to sing. Yeah. I sing in the shower.
Right.
Someone called me a jazz philosopher. You and I, we speak, that's our instrument.
Right.
Just like a musician. But an audience doesn't have to be there to
experience the joy. Interesting.
And I think that you are disempowered if an audience's response to you, it's a great dance, there's no doubt about it. When you're feeding the audience and the audience is feeding you back and something wonderful is going on. But we are disempowered if we think that at any given moment, the success of our message is dependent on the popularity of the message.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there have
Otherwise,
been moments.
You're going to be modifying your message.
You're a whore then.
To
absolutely.
Yeah.
You're dead. It's over.
Yeah.
I mean, I have never said, what am I going to lecture on tonight? Well, what do people want to hear? That's hardly how I decide what to say.
Neither has anyone who's ever had any impact.
Exactly. So, you know, I want to speak the truth as clearly as I can understand it and see it for myself. And if it's appreciated and accepted by certain people, I'm deeply honored. And if it's not, that doesn't mean I said the wrong thing.
Right.
Especially in today's world, truth is not a popularity contest.
Yeah.
None of this is a popularity contest, especially when you see what's popular in this world and often what isn't.
Is part of our unhappiness just that we have raised our standards?
We're
is part of our unhappiness
brats.
That we're spoiled?
We're
yeah.
spoiled brats. You know, and that's been, once again, the value of working so much with people with cancer and AIDS as I
yes.
have. I mean, you hear people these days, you know, just going on and on and crying because mommy didn't give me piano lessons. And, and you know, I'll say, come with me, I want to show you somebody who has real problems, who, by the way, is so much more optimistic and enthusiastic
exactly.
about life than you are.
Exactly. How do you give people that? That experience of contrast, have you had that in your life before you worked with other people? Is that part of what shaped you?
I myself have suffered.
Yeah.
I myself have suffered. So I as most people have, but most people also dissociated from the lesson of their own suffering, I believe.
Right.
Having been there, as I have in my own life, I appreciate an anxiety-free day on such a level.
Peace is the ultimate experience there.
Peace. And so on any given day, and being so aware of the things that can go wrong in a person's life because of how much I've experienced and how much I see all around me, people who are sick, there was a man who stood up in my lecture in New York last month, and he was talking about how he had had a fall and he'd broken his leg, but he'd broken it like a lot of places. It was a severe fall. And then something happened, I forget what, and he was almost well and he fell in the bathtub or something and I was broken again. Something really, really like sad on a certain level.
Right.
And I really fell for him and I had compassion for him. But I know who comes to my lectures. And I said to him, and he was saying, I've been saying to God, why would this happen to me, blah, blah, blah.
Wrong question.
And I said, I just want to remind you, I do want to point out to you how many people in this room so envy your physical condition.
What a nice balance.
I heard Elizabeth Taylor say that once. She had gotten up out of her own sick bed, and she certainly had her physical traumas. And she'd gotten up out of her own sick bed to go speak at an AIDS conference in San Francisco. And she said the reason it meant so much to her to do that was because as sick as she was, she knew that she had a very good basis for assuming she would get well. And she came for the people who were not assuming that they would get well.
What's a miracle?
A shift in perception.
Yes, isn't it?
You saw life one way, and then you just leave that behind. It's death. It's you let the dead bury the dead, and you no longer see through a glass darkly.
How do you create a miracle?
You choose again, where you find yourself judging someone, and then all of a sudden you say to yourself, who am I to judge them? What do I know? What do I know? Why don't I just assume that they're a good guy instead of assuming they must not be? Why don't I choose to focus on their innocence instead of their guilt? Why not choose to focus on what they're capable of rather than the mistakes of their past? And the more I choose to do that, the reason I'm doing it is because the more I choose to do that in terms of other people, the more I will be able to have the experience of doing it towards myself.
How do you forgive? Is that the process?
Basically, that's what forgiveness is. Genuine forgiveness is relinquishing the belief, all the thoughts that you have that a person isn't good enough, that the mistakes are what's real, that the possibilities are not infinite in this situation. Those are all fearful thoughts. When you relinquish the fearful thoughts and instead see all the love that has been, that is, and that can be in the future, that, according to the Course in Miracles, is the experience of forgiveness.
And that is a miracle within itself.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I love about what you teach is I hear so often this word, dysfunctional family. It drives me up the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And, what I tend to say is, show me a functional family.
Right, and me too. I say we all grew up in dysfunctional families.
Give me a break.
And if you didn't, you went to a dysfunctional school, so.
I have a dysfunctional
It's a dysfunctional world. That's the whole point.
So what's functional?
I don't think you find functional anything in broad strokes in the world today. But functional is a moment-by-moment process by which you join in any situation with any persons in a state of grace and beneficence and goodwill.
Interesting.
As opposed to anything else.
Maybe functional also is, I think, what one of the things that we both teach is focus equals reality, and whatever you focus on, you feel, seek and you find. And maybe functional is looking for the good, looking for the love, because you're going to, if I look for what's terrible in you, I look for what's terrible in me, we'll find
it.
Look
what's
great, you're going to find.
Absolutely. You want to find the guilt in somebody, you can do that.
Yeah.
You won't
Whether
be happy, by
not.
The way. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know.
You'll come here with your own frame of reference and interpreting
yes.
it.
But if they're not, I think it's even more than that for me, which is that none of us are an enlightened master
sure.
that I know of. Therefore, if you want to find someone's mistakes and their guilt, I'm sure you can.
Right.
But is that what you want? Is that the world you want to dwell in? See how bad they are?
Why do we have that frame of reference? Why are we so geared towards if someone is doing well,
is
that we've got to find something wrong with them so that we're not...
Because your own ego, it's about your own self, your own ego, which is the mind in you, the force of mind within you, which is so invested in your not winning.
Why?
Because that is the voice of the mind, which is anti-love. The Course in Miracles says, do not underestimate the vengeance of the ego. It is suspicious at best and vicious at worst.
So when you speak of ego, you're talking about that part of us that thinks that we're going to be better by being different or apart from, as opposed to the part of us that knows that we're connected with everyone.
Absolutely. It's the belief in separation, the belief that we exist in isolation rather than in unity. And that belief in isolation leads to terror, because unconsciously, if you believe that you're just this one little isolated speck of dust, by definition, if you feel separate from the rest of the universe, which you do thereby, you will feel terrified of the rest of the universe. It will seem like a hostile environment.
What is the belief?
And anybody's success will seem to you like a possible threat to your own
uniqueness or identity or sense of
If they
ego.
Succeed, I'll fail, when the truth of the matter is, the more they succeed, the more I'm capable of it.
Interesting.
It can liberate within myself the capacity to do the same. That's why it's so important, I think, to bless other people's success.
Absolutely.
Honor it and approve of it, because whatever you honor and approve of and support within someone else, the real person you're always talking to is yourself. The Course in Miracles says ultimately you'll realize there is no one outside yourself. You're always talking to yourself, and if you put somebody down, you're putting yourself down. And you will, you know, I love the line in the Course where it says, if you judge someone else, then even if they're so pure they don't judge you back, you'll feel like they did.
That's neat. I don't remember reading that. That's fabulous. Well, it's so true. You see that in the economic world, especially. You see people who are doing well financially, and that's the big theme right now, especially after some people abuse things. The generalization is that anyone who succeeded financially has done something wrong.
Yes.
And it's the worst part about it is the very people who are making these judgments want to do better in financial terms.
Such a poverty consciousness.
But they're attacking and attacking mentally. They're not attacking verbally, they're attacking mentally, saying, you know, they must have done something wrong. That teaches you that the only way, you know, that if you succeed financially, if you have economic well-being, that you must have done something wrong.
And it's also people who seem to think they know what you're going to do with your money, when the truth of the matter is more conscious people having money would be a great gift to this planet.
Yeah. What do you say to people who, I deal with people like that all the time, who, even some of which are very close friends of mine, who think, my gosh, you know, I want to make a difference. And I used to do this myself. And the way to make a difference, you know, why should I have more than anybody else? Why should I do well financially? The people who think spirituality means that they can be abundant mentally, emotionally, and physically, and maybe in the relationships, but they had to keep this other area separate. Called
well,
financial.
Jews never made that mistake.
Nah.
So I didn't grow up with that particular prejudice.
Well, but a lot of people do. And if you want to help them, what is the belief change, or what is the perception change that needs to be made? So that, I think I read in your book, you said something like, there's nothing spiritual about societies where money no longer flows.
Oh, there's nothing spiritual about a breadline. There's nothing holy about poverty. There's nothing beautiful about a family scared that they're not going to be able to feed the kids even though mommy and daddy are both working. What's beautiful about this? This is ugly when money stops circulating in a society. This is dangerous. And many people, in the guise of a spiritual viewpoint, actually promoting the thoughts of poverty is a very dangerous thing.
What is the alternative? What is the belief system these people need to have, especially when they're in a mode of, let's say, struggling?
I think that people can be made to see that energy is not finite.
Right.
That this is not about a pie, and if one person has a piece, somebody else has less. At the center of real wealth, of stable financial abundance,
right,
is the production of energy. The production of energy in which everyone wins. You write a book, I write a book. We produce the energy, which then is a win for everyone. It's a win for the person reading the book. It's a win for the publisher. It's a win for us. Win, win, win.
Right.
So many people are still stuck in the belief that if I win, you lose. If we were making our money off the exploitation of people, off the destruction of anything of the earth or people,
bodies,
then in fact, it's not a holy thing.
Right.
And I talk about money in my book. Money itself is like anything else. As the Course in Miracles says, it can be used by spirit, love, or it can be used by fear. Definitely, money has been used for purposes of fear and destruction in this society. No one is disagreeing with that here.
Right.
But it doesn't have to be. You can't blame money for what some people have done with money.
Yeah. I think money magnifies what people are. If they're
yes.
got problems, they got real
yes.
big problems.
I remember once in my office when money was a real difficulty for me, and I was really scared because it looked for a while like I was going to have to let people go. So what I saw was that if I lose money, I saw how many other people were going to lose the money that they needed to make a living.
Right.
And the more money I have, the more people make money because I employ them. I mean, why isn't anybody pointing to that? I guess because, like you said, there's this assumption from the kind of people who would be down on you to begin with that you're hoarding it or...
Yeah. Not seeing all the added value that's happening in everybody's lives.
But anybody who is making money from a conscious place understands the laws of circulation.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the faucet could be turned off any time. At least I do. I don't know how you feel about it, but I do. And, you know, it's not a matter of will somebody find out. God finds out. The universe sees every thought you have. And I think also if you've made money out of your innocence, you have no desire to shift gears now.
Yeah.
It's worked so far. Right?
Well, maybe it is getting people to realize that, as you said, that there isn't scarcity is not the reality, that if they find a way to add more value, if they can do something that gives more than what they expect back, they'll always be prosperous. I think in your book you said, you had a really interesting comment. You talked about how the most impactful people in our society are not the people necessarily who even have made something or even do things, but who have somehow instilled the inspiration, the energy, the John F. Kennedys, if you will, the Martin Luther Kings.
Unleashed energy on an invisible plane.
Yeah, yeah. It appears that you're doing that on a major scale, even though it may not be your goal. How do you feel about that?
Well, when you say I do that on a major scale, my first thought was, oh, you mean my daughter.
Oh, that's nice. I like that. I like that very much. I respect you for that.
I mean, isn't that why this, you know, the I Ching says, the Chinese philosophers say, if the family unit falls apart, the society falls apart. The flip side of how destructive the relationship between a mother and child can be is how positive it can be. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most important. I think parenting our children, loving our mates, this to me is the grand scale. And that's what's so terribly wrong with the society is that people don't know that.
How do we get our children to really focus on loving when the society is teaching them to fear? By our example? By our caring? By consistency? What does it?
I think children listen to mommy and daddy before they listen to anyone else.
If mommy and daddy will talk with them.
Mommy and daddy talk to them.
Exactly. Heart.
And if mommy and daddy live it, it's amazing how much power mommy and daddy have if they spend time with their children. My father used to say to me, we come home from school today. They didn't teach you any facts today, did they? Whatever they tell you, let me just tell you, there aren't any facts because the white man rewrote history for his own purposes and don't you forget it. I mean, I was told that when I was 6 years old. Yeah, his daddy.
Is your
dad don't you forget
alive?
It's a bunch of imperialists out there and don't believe what they say because all the educational system is a way to make you a pawn in their game and don't forget it. It's entrenched power. They're out to oppress all minorities. They're out to impress the small man and don't forget it. And I didn't forget it. I didn't. Making the, he still calls me up. You making the revolution today, little sister? Best I can, Daddy. Best I can.
I want to interview your dad.
It's true.
Oh, that's great.
Oh,
he
pulled
you off to Vietnam.
Yeah, he took me to Vietnam. He thought the military. And I came home from the seventh grade one day, and I said, my teacher told me that if we don't fight in Vietnam, then soon we'll be fighting on the shores of Hawaii. And my father filed suit against the Houston School Board.
Oh, my gosh.
And he took us to Vietnam. You want to see what war is? I'll show you what war is. You see those bullet holes? And do you know, little sister, why we're losing the war in Vietnam? Do you know why we're losing the war in Vietnam? Because God is not on our side. Do you understand? God does not promote imperialism, especially imperialism of the rich white man. Do you understand?
Oh, my gosh. Well, parenting. I think you have quite a few references.
You don't forget these things. I was talking to my 2-year-old about entrenched power and the threat. And you will be a threat to the system, darling, but just come home because mommy will always love you.
Well, let's talk about relationships as long as we're into parenting and we're talking about money. Let's talk about relationships. I know that in our society, there's so many people that are looking to get out of pain by finding somebody who's going to do it for them.
If you want to increase the pain, keep thinking that thought.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, what is the primary message that you think people need to hear to balance their experience in relationships, to have a real joy in relationships?
I think that the issue for me and from everything I've learned as well as experienced is that if I come into a relationship thinking that you can complete me, my core belief is that I lack.
Right.
And so I will unconsciously create a relationship in which I will get evidence which proves me right. I lack.
Right.
If, on the other hand, I feel that I enter with you as a complete person. You know, sometimes whenever I hear somebody in a relationship say, oh, they really complete me, it makes me a little nervous. I rather like the thought that, oh, I love being the complete person that I am. How I love walking along the road with this other complete person.
How much fun. What synergy.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting.
Yes, we're two complete people, not two emotional invalids joined at the hip.
Yeah. And you can bring something in a relationship rather than making a relationship
you
a place you go to get.
Coming from your abundance rather than your lack.
Yeah.
It's such common sense because, you know, I say in my book, I have this line about, I used to think that there was a man who would come and take my desperation away, and then I realized I better deal with it before he got here. think I better deal with that first. Because what man is going to meet me and think, oh, what an attractive, charming, desperate woman I met last night. And then, of course, you try to cover it up so they won't see that you're desperate, but then they can smell it anyway. It's awful.
Yeah. You had a wonderful metaphor in your book I loved, which was you talked about a relationship and you talked about romance and how everybody talks about having, boy, I want so much romance. And you said, you know, they're looking for a PhD and they haven't been to kindergarten
exactly.
yet. And you gave a great metaphor I wish you'd share about the flower in friendship.
Yes, the rose. Idea of a long-stemmed red rose. And the stem on a rose is just this dark green line, really. And that's the friendship, the brotherly love, the Christ connection. And then at the end of the stem is this beautiful blossom. And because we're so sensation-oriented, that's the romance and that's what we go to. Forgetting that that blossom cannot survive without the stem because all the nourishment gets into the blossom from the stem. You cut that blossom off the stem and it will not live for very long. And then when I mentioned this image...
But the stem can grow another blossom.
And that's what I was just going to say. I mentioned the image at a lecture once and a woman raised her hand. She said, I've been married for 40 years. And I also want to tell you that it's seasonal. If you just nourish that stem, that's what a rose bush is. She says, you keep nourishing that stem and the blossoms will come around when they come around.
Well, what about the thorns?
Well, the thorns are there. Let's not kid ourselves.
That's true.
The thorns are there, but if you keep feeding that stem, you get to the blossom. And also the thorns on another hand, too, they protect the blossom, don't they? That's a large reason why the thorns are there, because of all the things that would climb up to destroy the blossom and can't get there.
Interesting. I like it. Tell me, you shared a wonderful story. I loved it. I howled reading it, and it also made me respect you immensely.
Oh, thank you.
It was a story you talked about this man you were dating, I believe, and
stood me up before
stood
the
you up at
everybody
the
mentions that story.
Well,
that's definitely
it's such a
the hit
story,
of the book.
You know?
I guess so. I never knew that story.
Well,
would
you know, it's extraordinary. Would you share it?
Well, the story was I was dating someone, and it was when the Los Angeles Olympics.
Yes.
And he was a television reporter, and he wasn't working the Olympics, but somebody gave him tickets to go to the opening ceremony, which was this major event.
Right.
And he only had one ticket. Or now that I think about it, who knows if he really only had one ticket. But he told me probably he had another ticket and he had a date by my actual. Well, whatever. He told me that he only had the one ticket. And we were supposed to have a date after the ceremony.
Right.
So.
You stayed home and watched it on
television. I was going to stay home and watch it on television. And we were going to meet afterwards. So because I watched it on TV, I knew when it was over. And it was like late afternoon, early evening. And then I thought to myself, well, you know, it's going to take probably an hour for him to get out of the stadium. I mean, there's so many people there. So an hour passed, and then 2 hours. But I thought after 2 hours, well, you know, it must be just a madhouse around there. I was dressed. I was ready. And the evening progressed, and the man never called. Never called. And I was flip-flopping between deep worry and being triggered by the thought that I had been completely humiliated, made a fool of, because obviously I was being stood up. And I didn't know where to go. I didn't know whether to hate him or to call the police. And we'd been dating a little while, and the hours went by, and once again, I took my makeup off, and I ended up getting in bed because it was a night of torment. And he never called, and I kept calling his house, and there was no answer. And finally, about 6 o'clock in the morning, I called his house, and he answered.
You'd called like at midnight and at 3, right?
Yeah, I called all night.
Oh, my gosh.
So finally, about 6 o'clock in the morning, I called and he answered. And I said, I think I called him Mike in the book. I said, Mike? He said, yeah. I said, this is Marianne. He said, oh, hi. I said, well, what happened? We were supposed to have a date yesterday. And he said, I had a late night. And, oh, my stomach I just died inside. I felt so awful.
Were you enraged or were you just...
I was enraged. I felt, you know, behind rage at a moment like that is just such
hurt.
A complete hurt, right?
Yeah.
And I remember I put the phone down and then, I don't know, I went back to sleep or something. But then I thought to myself, this is going to be okay. By noon, this guy's going to show up at my door and he's going to have 12 gorgeous long-stemmed roses and a bottle of champagne and say, baby, I'm so sorry. Let's go to brunch. You know, I'm going to show you what. Well, he never did. Not only did he not show up at my door, he never called.
Oh, my gosh.
So I was, I started doing this mantra that I have recommended to many people. I forgive you, Mike, and I release you to the Holy Spirit. The problem that I was having was that I could see two options for ways to deal with this, and both of them I knew would get me nowhere. One was to, if I ever had the opportunity, tell this man off big time. What makes you think you can treat me this way? But this is a ridiculous response because, number one, obviously he doesn't care. And also, it will only help his ego completely invalidate you.
Yes.
Well, you know, she's an angry woman.
Yes.
Right? The other response is, oh, it's okay. You know, I understand, you know. And I, you know, I think I say in my book at that point, I understand unconditional love, but not unconditional dating. So I didn't know what to do, but he wasn't calling anyway, so it wasn't like I, you know, was I had to decide by tonight. I just knew from A Course in Miracles perspective that it was not what I did that would create or obstruct a breakthrough. What I thought, what was happening in my own consciousness would create or obstruct a breakthrough. If your mind is aligned with truth, then no matter what you do or don't do, things will ultimately be okay.
Right.
If your mind is not aligned with truth, then no matter what you do or don't do, you will ultimately hit the wall again.
Right.
And I knew it was not of God for me to just say, oh, it's okay, darling, you know, why don't you come over and I'll make you dinner? That's not of the light because it shows no respect for a woman. It shows no honor for a woman, and I believe women should be honored, and I believe men should be honored. But I think a large part of what's wrong with relationships in the world today is that we do not honor one another. And I do not feel that I'm serving myself, and I also don't feel I'm serving other women by allowing a man to dishonor me.
Right.
Every time a man dishonors me, I think about all the women he must have known before he got to my house who allowed this, starting with his mother, by the way, but that's a different topic. So
I can hear women cheering in the background. Right.
Isn't it true? It's like what you're doing for the next woman down the line. It's like taking back a pair of bad shoes and not telling anybody you were bad. So I just
potent metaphor.
Right. Women though.
Yeah.
So I just knew the shift had to be in my own consciousness and God would create a miracle, and I didn't know what it would look like, and I kept saying the mantra over and over, I forgive you, Mike, and I release you to the Holy Spirit. And you know, mantra makes you high. It alters your consciousness. So you get to the point where you're more into the mantra, which focuses you on truth, than you are into any of the thoughts that your ego usually goes into, like, will he ever call? What will I say? I must be unattractive or whatever.
Right.
So finally, I think it was around 2 weeks later, of course, it's the moment after the moment in which you no longer care. That's when they call, right? So sure enough, probably the minute I stopped thinking every time the phone rang, is it him? It was him. It was the middle of the day. I remember it was a Saturday, I think. And I picked up the phone. He went, Marianne, hi, this is Mike. I went, hi. And the amazing thing was I had done this mantra for so long, this I forgive you, Mike, and I release you to the Holy Spirit, that I genuinely felt warmth in my chest when I heard his voice. I said, how wonderful to hear your voice. I didn't feel any need to, like, hold back or withhold my approval or anything.
Right.
I said, how wonderful to hear your voice. And I felt coming from him this kind of relief, like, oh, I thought she might be mad at me or something.
Right.
I guess his date for the evening wasn't available. So I don't know. So he said,
Mike's a real winner.
He's a great guy. He said, how are you? I said, fine. And he said, well, and then there was a silence. I guess he was, like, registering with just disbelief that I was being so friendly. And he said, well, I'd love to see you. I can't believe he said that.
You've got to give an A for guts.
Isn't it the truth? He said, I'd love to see you. And I remember saying, I said, when? And he said, tonight? And you know, I mean this from the bottom of my heart. That mantra had so worked on me, and the words were just pouring through me. I was not deciding what to say. I felt all this affection for him, and this love, and this tenderness, and this sweetness. And I said, you know, I got to tell you something, Mike. We don't speak the same language. We don't do the same dance, I think, in relationships. And I really like you. And if you ever want to have lunch, please call me. You know, we've really, our hearts have met. There has been genuine contact of the heart.
Right.
And I will not forget that. And if you ever want to have lunch, let's have lunch. But as far as dating you is concerned, I have to pass. And
yes.
Yeah, really. And then I got off the phone. And I remember, because this is what I was learning in terms of the spiritual, I think some people get confused. Well, does spirituality mean I have to always say yes and say yes, come back over? I mean, that's before you learn you don't give your keys to a heroin addict. You love them and you lock the door. So I
trust in God and tie up your camels.
Exactly. So I got off the phone and I wondered for just a moment, a fraction of a second, did I just do the wrong thing? Did I deny love to a brother? And what I got this image in my mind of champagne corks going off in the clouds.
Yeah.
And that this had been a breakthrough. And I had learned that through forgiveness, I was not made into a doormat.
Right.
A doormat is when you pretend to be angry and you sit. That's not what happened here. I could trust that when my heart is in a mode of forgiveness, my heart will know how to set healthy boundaries. Sometimes people think that if the Holy Spirit is giving you the loving response, that the response will always be yes. Sometimes the loving response is no. We know that as parents. Yeah. If I love my child, does that mean that I'm going to give them anything they want anytime? No, that's called lazy parenting.
That's right.
That's not loving parenting.
That's not a good friend either.
Right. And that's what I learned. I learned that you can, as they say today, set boundaries, although that phrase is tired also. You can say no and it be the loving response to both people.
I asked you to share that because I think, man, as I said when we started, I think that is the thing, one of the things I respect most about you is you bring a strength to the concept of love. Because I think a lot of people say, well, I should just, the problem's not working out, I should just give it to God, I just should pray, I should just love, 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 and they don't do their part.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, faith without works is dead.
Yes.
And I think what you bring to it is you show the balance that love can be a very strong and powerful emotion.
A Course in Miracles says this is a practical course. And it prides itself on being a, quote, practical course attested to by the experience of inner peace.
You know, so much of the challenges that we see, I think, in life come out of us not being present, not just being with one another, not just communicating with one another, not just being in a natural state of love. And what we're doing instead is running a pattern.
In unconsciousness.
Without a doubt. You shared a good example also, I thought, in your book you talked about there was a time when you were in a relationship with this gentleman. It sounded like he was a good friend of yours, if I remember correctly. And you were both talking about the possibility of being intimate. And he was saying, well, I don't know if we should do that because one of us is going to get hurt. And I believe you said, which one? And he said, you. And you kind of like had a state change.
And that reminds me of your work.
Yes.
That I, it was a reprogramming.
Yeah, exactly.
I went
That's
back.
I noticed it.
And I, and that reminds
well, share,
me.
Share what you did because I thought it was really
It was in this room, actually. And he said what you just said. He said, one of us would get hurt. And I went into a very reactive moment.
Yeah.
And he said, see, I couldn't be with you. You're too, you take everything so personally. I saw what you just did. He said, I saw that reactiveness in you just now. He said, I couldn't have a relationship with that. And I knew that he was right. I knew that that's a place I go into that is not cool, that men do not appreciate, that no one can appreciate. And I said to him very honestly and sincerely, what does a woman who has it all together say in that moment?
What does a woman who has it all together?
I don't know what
you're
to
awesome.
Do right there. Because
you're
awesome. Like you said,
what
you're running
you,
a pattern.
What,
you're
not you caught yourself, though. That's so great you caught yourself there. Most people won't catch themselves. What made you catch yourself? It was just so much pain from the past you finally said, I'm sick of this crap?
You want to change. You intend to change.
You have to change.
You know that you've reached this moment with many people, and this is a moment where you mess up.
And you catch it. Instead of just letting it go by or acting like it's not there, you catch it and you ask a better question.
But that's what, you see, and once again, going back to your work too, if you're running the pattern, you have to have faith that there is another pattern you could move into.
Exactly.
But sometimes we don't move into another pattern just because we don't know what it is.
Yeah, or we fear that the next pattern might be worse.
Maybe.
The uncertainty.
I just didn't know how to do it right.
So what did he say?
So he said to me, he said, well, you could have just said, don't flatter yourself. So I said, okay, go back. It's like an acting class
right.
when you're a child. You do the scene again.
Right.
And I think I said in the book, it's like an actress working with a great director. Okay, let's go back. Let me have another chance at that. Let me have a chance. I said, okay, say what you said. He said, well, I don't think that I could have a relationship with you because I think one of us would get hurt. And I said, well, who do you think would get hurt? And he said, you. I said, ha, don't flatter yourself. And I just said it like, you know, very light and airy. And you know, when I said it, I felt it.
That's neat. Didn't you start
laughing?
That was
a kind of neurolinguistic reprogramming.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And I started laughing. I was laughing. I was jumping up and down. I did it on a break.
And what reaction did it have on him when you did
he
that?
He was great. Well, he was and is a great old friend, you know, and he got that. And I think it also impressed him. I think, to be honest, and I hope I don't have any ex or present boyfriends who listen to this tape and disagree
well,
with this.
That's the only people we're sending it to.
I think that I can honestly say that one of my strong points is that I'm not only willing but eager to change. I think you get to a point in your life where any criticism, valid criticism, that someone levels against you is something you already knew about.
Right.
If you're conscious enough.
Right.
So if they criticize you, you know you would have done it differently if you had known how.
Right.
But I don't think a relationship, once again, that's the whole thing in the course in relationships. A relationship is not supposed to be where you're auditioning for someone, and if you get it wrong, they're gone.
Right.
It's supposed to be where they see the truth about you, but because of your willingness to change, part of the constant discovery process between two people is that you're helping midwife in the other person the higher place they're capable of. But when you're in the presence of someone who's condemning you and judging you for your weaknesses, you're not given the opportunity to go into the next higher place.
You're busy defending and trying to validate yourself.
And you're so afraid to show your weakness because they're going to leave. But really, we need to be able to show our weaknesses and even discuss them with the other person, but from a place of, and I'm so willing to get beyond this, and with your help, I think I can.
You talk about that, you know, unconditional love is the most important emotion to feel. Where does growth come in that process? I think also in relationships, I remember you talked about how, you know, a relationship, there can be all this great love, but if there's no growth, the relationship's going to die. Is that a fair representation?
Well, absolutely, because if your personality structure, I think we're probably all meeting people at this point in our experience that we've known maybe thousands of years before. Mm-hmm. To say there's love between us is ultimately not enough if there's not a personality structure to hold it. That's the tragedy of so many relationships. The hearts connect, but the personalities just are out
what
to kill one
by
another.
That?
We've all had negative relationships. And when you look back, so often you see it's not that the two people didn't love each other. Mm-hmm. But living on this earth, the less conscious you are, the more dissociated you are from the truth about yourself. Mm-hmm. So you come with love into a situation, but you don't lead with love. You don't lead with your love. For whatever reason, you keep it hidden. You don't express from your beingness of love. You express from your fear. And sometimes you think they should be able to read your mind.
Sure.
And know that you love them, even though you're
especially
acting like
really
a jerk.
You.
Especially if they really love you.
That's right.
Right? So your love is ineffectual.
Mm-hmm.
As Barbara DeAngelis, I once heard her say, and I thought it was very good, she said, it's not enough for you to love someone. They have to feel your love.
Right. And if they're not, you've got to be able to
what good? I mean,
that.
I've had people say to me, but I love you. And I'm sure I've done it to people, but I love you. Well, it's really odd that you do, because all I know is how depressed I am every day.
I'm transformed by your love.
Transformed
by a state of depression.
Mean, right. And, but that's what the ego will do. I love you. Therefore, I have thrown this invisible lasso over your neck to make you feel like you should be due for me at all times.
Can anyone make us feel anything?
No one can make us feel anything. No one can make us feel bad, and no one can make us feel good. But people can touch us. People can trigger us. People can remind us of the best or the worst within us.
Yes.
And in that sense, it can be very, you know, I was thinking of two relationships just this morning. One relationship that made me feel very bad, and one relationship that made me feel very good. And I think I was loved equally in both relationships.
Mm, isn't that fascinating? So the difference was the style of communication, the personality, the
yes,
rules of
yes.
the relationship.
Yes, one was always trying to nag me, fix me, make me into someone better, not really helping me to expand into someone better, but thinking if he was always telling me what to do, maybe I would get there, which is a way of stopping someone's yeah. progress. I was loved, but so what?
It's like criticism is not bad if it's really given in a spirit of love where you feel it.
Absolutely.
But if you don't feel that, you're never going to hear it. It's not going to
exactly.
make it any better.
Exactly. And someone else can honor you for all that you're doing right,
yeah.
support you in all you're doing right. You know, somebody wants to just tell you about what you're not getting right today. Well, that's not doesn't promote growth or joy or love. Someone else can talk to you about how good you are today.
Yeah.
And then you're so in such a wonderful state that promotes those also very important moments where you can also share from your heart and from your truth and with compassion things that are not working, which is also a major purpose, I believe, of intimate relationships.
I agree.
Where you get down and you really look at the places that aren't so good.
Right. You shared the story that I'd heard before of Ram Dass, where he talks about a policeman, if I remember correctly.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, maybe you could share that, because it's a fascinating example of how what's so familiar to us, even when it's not good, we tend to stay in. Would you share that?
Well, that's the story that I had heard on a Ram Dass tape, where a child had been abused by its mother, and the police matron came to take the child away from the mother, because the mother beat the child. But when the police matron went to take the baby away from its mom, it kept trying to get back to its mother. Screaming, crying, because the mother was what it knew. And it's what you were talking about. We run unconscious patterns.
And we tend to stay with the familiar rather than take on the uncertainty. The uncertainty, though, if we have some faith, gives us everything that we want.
Oh, but Tony, you find this so much, particularly with women. Don't you feel that with women in relationships where men do not honor them and they stay in those relationships because they're so afraid that they won't find anybody else out there? But I feel it's such a dangerous, and I was saying to a girlfriend the other night, this is such a dangerous statement for you to be making to the universe that this is okay with you. I told a story, I think it's in my book, where I used to say to the universe, why do you send me men like this? And the answer I thought I got back was, oh, we thought you didn't mind. There was nothing in my beingness that said I have standards and there's a minimum standard here of honor and respect. And it's honor and respect for the Son of God. It's not just honor and respect for me. It's just the way people should be treated on this earth.
You know, the key, I think, is, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, it's not a demand for respect. It's that you have so much within yourself that you just wouldn't even expect anything else from somebody else. And if they don't give it to you, you deal with them the kind of love and the gentleness and the beauty that you did with, quote, Mike, you know?
Yes, but you know that, and exactly. And, you know, I talk in the book about how if I ate a piece of aluminum foil, my system would regurgitate it because it doesn't belong there. If I think that I'm a valuable person, then as you're saying, anybody who gives me evidence to the contrary, just my system seeks to repel it psychologically, just as my physical system would seek to repel a piece of...
In fact, you probably wouldn't ingest it in the first place.
Exactly.
In fact, I think you had a great phrase. You said that some lady in one of your seminars stood up and said, how come I keep attracting men like this? And you said, that's not the problem. The problem is that you give them your number.
Right. Right. Exactly. It's that you were attracted to a man like that.
And that you fall through.
Right. And there's no way to speed the process by which someone is simply no longer attracted to pain.
Interesting.
And there's a payoff in that pain. You know, I think something else, Tony, that I didn't write about in my book, but I'm sure you believe also, because I see people underestimate the amount of bleed through that exists in the various aspects of our lives. Somebody who thinks, well, I can be with a man who never treats me well, who basically all the stimulus I get from him and the input I get from him is that I'm not that valuable, but I can still go out and be a powerhouse in my profession. If you are not supported in one area of your life, and if you do not live from a high beam in one area of your life, I don't think ultimately you can live from a high beam in any other area of your life. So in a way, I know for myself, saying in my personal relationships there's a certain kind of input that is simply not acceptable for me is a way of affirming that the work I have to do in the world is too important to allow myself. And I don't mean that my work is any more important than anyone else's. Yeah. I think we all must realize that what we do in the world is too important to allow it to be held back by this constant cheap drama that so many people stay in their relationships. And also, as I said in the book, God doesn't get rid of the drama. He just gets rid of the cheap drama.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so many people's relationships are full of the cheap drama, the fighting and the craziness and the making up. And then the making up and the blah, 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 blah. Well, in a real relationship, there's also drama. And sometimes we fight and sometimes we go through it, but it's high drama. Because it's the high drama of the genuine growth by which a boy becomes a man and a girl becomes a woman. It's not the dysfunctional cheap drama anymore, though.
Well, the more the person respects themselves, the more the person loves themselves, the more they have to give. If they have self-loathing, if they have continuous fear that people are going to discover who they really are, then the relationship starts to have problems in the very beginning. How do you get people to have that kind of security within themselves? If you were going to give somebody advice and say, how do you create that security so I could attract that? In other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is so often I hear people say, well, I want to find this man or I want to find this woman in my dreams, and my advice to them always is become the kind of person that would attract that
person. Oh, I always say, first of all, there are not many enlightened masters available for dating in the major cities of America that I know of. But even if there were, the question to ask yourself is, if
you
they are there,
view of
would
America.
They date you?
That's even
the
better.
Way you are now, would they want you? Which is what you're saying.
Yes, exactly.
Look to yourself. If you want such a great person, I suggest you do several things, including shopping. Look at you, you're a mess.
I hear your father coming out now. Here he is, here he comes. Right. Here comes your dad.
I hope so. Sometimes, you know, people will say to me, why doesn't my soulmate get here? When will my soulmate get here? And I'll look at that person and I will think, if not say, thank God they're not here, you're a mess. It's not time. You have
you're here,
work
they leave,
to do
huh?
on yourself, right? And that happens. I mean, we've all been in relationships, I think,
sure.
where we feel, if I'd met that person a year later, I might have been ready.
Yeah. Let's talk about health.
Okay.
We're both, you know, big advocates, obviously, of people taking care of themselves. But what specifically I'd like to touch on is we're in a position right now, I think, where there's so many people living in fear about their health, primarily because of the communication about AIDS that's happening worldwide. And I think a lot of people see, like, it's, you know, when they have a dis-ease in their body, they see it as an attack, or it's God's way of, like, getting even for them for all their ills and so forth. Let's talk about it from a spiritual perspective. What is disease from a spiritual perspective?
Well, you know, a doctor once said to me, Marian, you're not sick, but you're not healthy either. We spend so much more time in this society thinking about sickness than we do thinking about health. you hear people talk more about how I want to avoid getting sick than about how I want the experience of health.
Right.
We so underestimate the power of our thoughts. Your body is often a reflection of your view of life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I always say to people, I'm not your physician. Your physician studies your illness. I'm a metaphysician. I study how to stimulate within you the forces of healing.
Hmm. And medicine studies disease. And
this studies disease. And health. We study health and we study healing, which always, I believe, the greatest psycho-immunological factor is the experience of love. This thought that we've got to hate, you know, this war against AIDS. This consciousness of war is the problem. It cannot possibly be the answer.
Mm-hmm.
The old paradigm is people thinking that war is the way of solution. And we have to understand that war and attack is the constant way of the recreation of a state of danger and not a state of peace. So, once again, all problems, the Course in Miracles says, stimulate from a state of fear or lovelessness, and the answer to every problem is love. So, whereas, for instance, I talk in my book about how many people do visualizations around cancer cells or the AIDS virus, where you're going to take a machine gun out and you're going to glow apart the cancer cell or the AIDS virus. The visualizations I do have to do with things like sending an angel to put its arms around the AIDS virus. Because what an AIDS virus or a cancer cell or any disease is a physical manifestation of your psychic scream. Now, let's say I'm screaming at you. Obviously, I'm in a hysterical state. Now, if you stand in front of me and say, Marianne, shut up! What will I do, Tony? I will scream louder. I will get more hysterical. If, on the other hand, you look at me and you say, I don't know why you're screaming, but I want you to know I'm not leaving the room. I'm here to listen to you. Scream if you have to scream, but I want to hear you because I love you. What will I do? I will stop screaming.
Hmm. Interesting. That's nice. You also, I loved your metaphor and your description of like cancer. I think your way of describing it said something along the lines of that what it is a cell that's become separate and it's developed its own ego.
I want to go. Yeah, it is. That. Well, it is the perfect metaphysical representation of the state of the ego. It's the cell that said, I don't want to exist to support the healthy functioning of the spleen or the blood. I want to go off and do my own thing. And so the individual cell, instead of finding its higher functioning in the contribution to the wellness of the whole system, goes off by itself out of its own greed for territory of its own, and it becomes a malignant mass. Now, does that sound like the modern world or what?
Yeah.
And that's what the ego is. A human being who has lost conscious contact with the fact that we are on this earth in order to contribute to a healthy functioning of an organism of which we are only a part. We are all individual cells. And instead, oh, I want to do all this. I want my money and my business and my everything for me. AIDS is also a rather fascinating metaphysical image, because what happens in AIDS, whenever there's a compromise of the immune system, is that things come into the system, opportunistic infections that should not be that difficult to handle. But the healthy cells that are supposed to go out there and gobble up those problems are just too tired. And of course, that's what you address, Tony, is just the tiredness. Nobody has the energy to go out and handle things. There was a case in New York several years ago. That man, Joel Steinberg, and mm-hmm. his foster daughter, Lisa, and Lisa Steinberg, was killed. And I was lecturing in New York then, as I do now. And everybody was talking about this horrible case where this man had killed this little girl. And I said, I pointed out that it came out in the papers after she died that neighbors on that block had known there were problems. They had called what is supposed to be the proper authorities numerous times and said something not kosher is going on in that apartment. And so we love to blame Joel Steinberg, when really what we have to address is how the most powerful nation in the world can so lack the capacity to respond to what should not have been a major danger to a child's life.
So what's the solution?
Is that each and every one of us relate to the idea, first of all, when it comes to the cancer cell, that we must live in contribution to the healthy functioning of the whole, that this is not just us out here by ourselves. That is a state of isolation and selfishness, which will ultimately produce fear. And we are here with a purpose. And that is so providing a healthy environment that the sicknesses do not have fertile ground. Someone told me, I had a meeting the other day with the head of the Weizmann Institute in Israel, and he told me that Sabin, who discovered the polio vaccine, gave many hundreds of thousands of dollars of his own money to the Weizmann Institute. Now, the subject he's interested in is cancer, but where he gave his money was not to cancer research, but to solar energy research. Because what he said to them was, you can find a cure for cancer, but if we keep polluting the environment the way we are,
look for the real cause.
The cancer will be there. So we keep trying to find a cure for cancer instead of addressing ourselves to a wholesome, healthy environment.
Right.
Physically, materially, ecologically, and mentally, spiritually, and emotionally.
So
in whose
so
presence,
many,
cancer will simply not be there.
So many people, though, I think in life, look at all the problems and they allow themselves to immediately get overwhelmed. They say, how can I deal with all this? There's just so much. And they just give up. They go into learned helplessness. And I think maybe the key message that you offer is that stop looking, you know, for the source of the pain, because the source is not the cause. And the cause always comes back to what is the state in which you, you know, evaluate all of life through.
Cynicism is just an excuse for not helping. When most of the time when people say, what difference can I make? What they're really saying is, what difference can I make that would get noticed by anybody and get me publicly acknowledged? Because each and every one of us know that you can live a life where somebody sleeps better tonight because you existed. And when that is your motivation, it might not get you Nobel Prize. It might not get you famous. It might not even save future generations.
They may not even know it was you.
Might not even know it was you.
Yeah, exactly.
But the planet will be a little bit better place today.
And so will you.
Mm-hmm. You've got to give up attachment to results. You have to give up attachment to results, not only in terms of your own personal gain, but I think also in terms of wanting to see any evidence that the world is this or that by the time you die. The world got into the horrible place it's in over many, many years. And it will be healed over many, many years.
It may not be a horrible place either, you know. I think you'd probably agree that what we think is horrible may just be part of an evolution of growth and expansion at another level.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But as long as there are suffering children, and there are suffering children, then there is darkness that we are to bring to light.
I agree. What's your purpose?
To love and to be loved. And I'd love to think I could be a good mom.
Could be or are. Looks like you are from what I'm hearing.
I'm trying.
Oh, don't give me this trying stuff. That's not what you're about. You're not trying.
Yeah. Of course, in the Course in Miracles, trying is not a bad word, but I understand what you're saying.
That's true. But that's a perfect example where you'll never know the final result. That's going to, you know, when they're in their 60s and 70s, they're still your babies.
Right,
you know?
Right. I do have images of her in therapy. My mother was always at those meetings.
What is something about you that very few people know or is a major misconception, do you think?
Oh, I'm a much softer touch than people seem to know. I'm a cancer, you know, so cancers, we're crabs, we have tough shells sometimes, and on the inside we're mush. It seems to me a lot of people, not ones who know me well, by the way, but people seem to think I'm a much tougher cookie than I am.
It's because you communicate with intensity.
Mm-hmm. Someone said to me that Gandhi said you must be soft as a feather and tough as a stone. Someone said to me once about my work, she said, you have to be so tough-skinned and so thin-skinned at the same time. We have to be tough-skinned to do the work we do, but we have to be so thin-skinned to receive the information.
And to let the love out. Interesting. Let me think how I want to wrap this up. This has been wonderful. Talk to me about spiritual surrender.
Well, I think we've moved into it several times when I keep going back to giving up results.
Mm-hmm.
See, I think that a lot of times when we have a specific goal in mind, what we are really unconsciously affirming is our faithlessness, because we don't think that the universe will support us unless we are consciously seeking it. I point out in my book that an embryo becomes a baby without any conscious effort. An embryo doesn't say, I will become a baby, I will become a baby, I will become a baby. It doesn't write affirmations. And the planets revolve around the sun, and a seed becomes a flower. I think that to really say, may God's will be done, means may my life be part of the flow, which is natural in this universe, by which all beings are supported in finding their maximal abundance in all areas. As opposed to, do I want to serve God, or do I want to be happy?
Right. Interesting dichotomy that
when
so
you,
many people
When
create.
You understand that asking that God's will be done means saying, may the will of love, which is my higher being, be done. And when I stand forth in full love, abundance of every kind will be reflected back. How could it not?
What makes you laugh?
My baby makes me laugh. Great sex makes me laugh.
Makes you laugh.
I don't know what else. When we were talking, just a minute, this thing about spiritual surrender, I wanted to say one more thing.
Oh, okay.
There has been a God manufactured by men's minds that we are now afraid of, because we think of him as a judgmental, angry God. So when we say, may God's will be done, if you believe in a judgmental, angry God and you say, may God's will be done,
right,
for all you know, his will is that you burn in hell.
Right.
So that's why it's so important that we address the fact that God can be seen as love, so that when you say, may God's will be done, you're asking that the will of the universe, that I be loved, be done. And that's why figuring out exactly who God is becomes the ultimate sort of existential issue.
So if God is love, and what God's will be done is that the loving will be done.
Absolutely. It's all that God is the love inside human consciousness.
Where are you going?
Where I'm going externally is irrelevant, and in a very real way is none of my own business. Hopefully, I'm going deeper. You know, one of the things I say about metaphysical thought, as we grow, and I think that you agree with this, our growth becomes less a matter of how much data we access outside.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about becoming more metaphysically complicated. It's about becoming simpler and simpler and simpler. I think the art of teaching, particularly, becomes less about speaking new things and more about speaking what we know from a deeper and deeper place, so we reach people at a deeper and deeper level. So where I hope I'm going is to a deeper place inside myself, so that I can also have the joy of reaching a deeper place inside other people. So whether I'm in Paris, Chicago, Los Angeles, or even on this planet is not the relevant point. Whether I'm going into closer into the heart of things is hopefully where I'm going.
Well, that has been the path of all great masters. And that's interesting. So many people are afraid when they're exposed to something like the Course in Miracles. There's this immediate fear and judgment that comes up about, well, it's Christian and you have a Jewish background.
Mm-hmm.
How do you help people through that? What do you tell them so that they can stay open and see that this is not so much a religious text?
Oh, it's not a religion. You know, when I first saw the Course in Miracles, as I wrote in my book, because I am Jewish, I saw the Christian language and I put it down. Even though I had read a lot of Christian theology in school, when I picked it up again a year later, I was so depressed I didn't even notice the language. You don't have to be a Christian to get great sustenance out of it. You know, there's only one truth, as we said before. I can listen to somebody talking about the Talmud, who's a real Talmudic scholar. I can listen to somebody giving a great lecture on Buddhism. I can listen to you. I can listen to whoever, and any one thing might not be the path that I'm going to go down as my main personal path.
Mm-hmm.
But truth is true, so I can gain from all of it. So I would think even someone who does not relate to A Course in Miracles as their personal path gains from hearing the principles, because the principles are the same as the truthful principles in every other system, just told from a different way. I think Aretha Franklin's the greatest singer in the world, but you know what? Some days I'm just not in the mood.
Right. And it's invaluable for someone who doesn't even believe in Christ per se in the traditional terms to still see that this is a person, one of many people that are great role models. I think you gave a great example about Picasso. Maybe you should share that. That's really great.
Picasso. Yes, right. I talked about how if you were a painting student and Picasso comes in one day and he says, look, I have a couple hours, and if you want, I could look through your notebooks and I could help you and give you my comments and my suggestions. Would you say, Pablo, no? I'm not interested. I'm doing this. And that's really what Jesus is. Pablo Picasso was a genius at painting. Beethoven was a genius at music. Shakespeare was a genius with words. People who are enlightened masters are geniuses in the way they use their minds and their hearts in connection to one another.
And they lived in a world that didn't have love and experienced love in every moment.
And they now have a function within this universe of helping us. That's what teachers do. So refusing help from anyone that might have something to give you is ultimately a childish response to life.
I'd agree. Well, we're looking forward to hearing very much more from you. And,
well, thank you so much.
I have enjoyed this immensely.
Me also. Thank you, Tony. Nice meeting you.
God bless.
God bless you.